Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
Welcome to another live episode of Unfiltered. I'm your host, Brian DeMarco, and sitting in for the absent and always missed Aaron Fitzpatrick is a new friend to this studio today, Mr. Justin Roilich. Say hello, Justin.
Hello.
And he's an old friend of mine and a writer of some snarky prose for a magazine, online magazine and news thing called Minionville, and an Emmy Award-winning writer and an old copywriter from my advertising days. So we go way back, and we can probably talk for hours, but we're going to try to keep it light here. But before I get into introducing Mr. Justin, I do have some news, as is our charge here, to keep you informed and updated and hopefully entertained while we sip beer and wine here at Roberta's on this balmy rainy day. As you know, it is Thanksgiving time is upon us, and we are basically awaiting turkeys and yams and all kinds of stuff. And it's funny because I was just reading this article today about it's kind of a PSA, but it's also a real life thing about grease fires and cooking turkeys can be very, very dangerous, apparently. And from what I read, and
frying turkeys,
frying
turkeys, which is why Texas is the number one state for grease and cooking related claims on Thanksgiving Day, according to State Farm.
Well, I mean, this data is actually fairly, very fresh data. It's 06 to 2010 when I think the first official fryolators were out on the market. And there's like late night, there's like ad infomercials for fryolators. But they're in good company, Texas, don't you think?
Illinois, Ohio, New York at number 4, which reminds us that Manhattan is only a small part of New York.
Well, and closely followed by the rest of the Rust Belt. Pennsylvania, Michigan, then there's, Florida, Minnesota, Indiana, and Louisiana. It's pretty funny. Like, some of the best culinary states are also on this list.
Twice as many grease and cooking-related claims on Thanksgiving Day compared to an average day in November. Put well, that in your pipe and smoke it.
Right, exactly. Well, it's, look, frying turkeys has become an incredible culinary experience, but also people... it's kind of this chemistry class from, 10th grade where the displacement of water in a vessel is greater than the mass, right? So people are fucking filling these turkey fry layers with hot grease and then putting a bird in. And when the grease comes spraying out, they don't realize that, they should have put the turkey in, put the grease in, taken the frying liquid and then taken the turkey out and heat up that liquid.
Is that how you die? No, I've never.
That's
done
how
it
you
before.
Would do it. Yeah,
because there's water in there too. I mean, you can't put the turkey is got a lot of water in it, right?
So. Well, it depends if you brine it or not. And then you should obviously brine a good turkey. Now, I'll give you my brining recipe in another time. But,
okay.
Tell me what this. You brought this article to me. So there's 1,000 fires, in this season, according to the National Fire Prevention Agency, from deep fryers. And it's causing how much in damage, Justin?
More than $15 million in property damage each year.
If you're frying a turkey, careful. Be careful. So, many times on this show, we had Goat-tober, where we instructed you to buy goats, and now we're basically telling you buy turkeys, buy heritage turkeys, buy turkeys that are only heritage in process, and be careful when you fry them. Please be careful.
It's been a big week in poultry news, actually. It was on Friday that McDonald's...
Well, before you do this, Justin, introduce yourself before we ramble on about McDonald's. But so Justin Roilich, everyone, tell us why you why anyone should first listen to you at all, and second of all, tell us why you're credible in this field and in this sort of parlance. of what we're talking about.
Okay.
Well, so a Twitter version of your resume, sir.
I'm a business and financial writer at minionville.com. That's Twitter version.
But what's your beat? Like, what's your tone? What's your beat? You know, in terms of what you write about and why people, like, what did you win your Emmy in?
That was actually for an animated business news show that was that ran. There were shorts that ran on the Fox Business Network when it first started. But I write on the site for I write about a number of different things. I'm writing about everything from the SEC and insider trading penalties and this week I wrote about the McDonald's. McDonald's dumped its egg supplier after a pretty shocking video came out on Friday night.
So describe that, because that's actually very interesting, especially to our listeners who primarily listen to talk about wine, but we talk about all kinds of food and how wine comes into play, not necessarily at McDonald's, but, you know, imagine then, you know, if a producer, you're saying, got dropped by McDonald's, like, you know, what is that? What are the financial implications of something like that?
Huge. I mean, huge. A group in Chicago called Mercy for Animals got a couple of their members hired by a place called Sparbo Farms, which is the fifth largest egg producer in the United States. They supply all the eggs to McDonald's restaurants west of the Mississippi.
Wow.
So you can imagine, it's 2 million eggs a day.
Seven days
a week.
2 million eggs a day, 7 days a week. You know, I should talk to my boys at Freakonomics about this, but my quick math is that's like a $50 million business.
That's just for McDonald's. They also supplied Target, which dropped them. They supplied Walmart, which dropped them 6 weeks ago for reasons that they won't specify.
So what do you have to be dropped by McDonald's? I mean, obviously getting the contract is probably the feather in the cap of any salesperson and probably makes or breaks your business, but losing that business must be devastating. Where are these? That's
actually the exact word that Sean Hackett, a commodities trader that I call on quite a bit in the course of my work, used that exact word, devastating, to describe losing an account, a supplier, a McDonald's supplier, any fast food company, really, to lose an account like that is devastating. I mean, the most famous success story of in the McDonald's supplier vanguard would be a guy named J.R. Simplot, who died a couple of years ago. He dropped out of school at 14. He grew up in a log cabin, one of these old-time stories. He was a potato. He figured out how to dry potatoes and onions, shipped them over to the troops in World War II. He was pressed into service by the government, and then he made a deal with McDonald's, and he said that
so wait, so how long is this deal? How long has the supplier been doing this for McDonald's?
You know, that's a good question. I don't know that figure off the top of my head, but all the McDonald's suppliers, the vast majority of McDonald's suppliers have been involved in a relationship with the company for a long time.
So McDonald's
doesn't shop for price, because if something like this happens, this is hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars in business. So they really want to avoid these sorts of things.
To what extent were the eggs unsafe, or was the infraction so, you know, heinous that McDonald's chose to pull out? Like, what exactly happened?
Well, it's kind of there are a couple of different answers. McDonald's, I spoke with the people at Mercy for Animals. I spoke with the people at the United Egg Producers, the trade group. I spoke with a number of different people in the agribusiness, and apparently the entire egg business is this way. I mean, they're
what way?
Well, the video. Sorry, I forgot we were on the radio. the video that came out shows
cruel treatment.
Cruel treatment. There are dead chickens in the cages that are left there while other chickens are laying eggs. consumption.
Is it like the scenes in Food Inc. with, you know, Michael Pollan and those guys talking about like the way that Purdue treated their chickens?
Yeah, yeah. This isn't anything no one hasn't seen before.
So this is more of the same.
This is more of the same. The interesting tidbit that I found out is that the Humane Slaughter Act, which was passed in 1958 and then again in 1978 with a few revisions, protects all animals up to the point of, protects all animals at the slaughter point. But farm animals don't qualify for the same protections against abuse, et cetera, that domestic animals do.
So let me see if I get this straight. If you're a cow, you are more protected than if you're a chicken.
If you're a cow, you're more protected at the point of when they kill you. You're more protected than a chicken. Birds do not qualify as farm animals, apparently.
So chicken is not a farm animal.
Birds at all. No poultry. It does not apply to poultry. So there's no law. It's all self-policing in the industry, which generally doesn't work, as we've seen in hundreds and hundreds of cases from banks to...
Right.
We
can't trust people to self-police or self-regulate. So
this came out, as I said, it's nothing that we haven't seen before, but when ABC News picked it up on Friday, it was obviously a real PR disaster for McDonald's, so they dropped them. But the eggs will be sold to somebody else. You know, the owner of Sparbo Farm said, we'll be selling these eggs to somebody else, and McDonald's is going to have to find somebody new to supply the eggs. But according to Mercy for Animals, this is an industry-wide situation, so it's not going to be so easy.
So let me ask you, do you think, I mean, and this is obviously, this is so interesting to me, we could talk about it the entire time, but we're going to have to take a break soon and then move on to more wine-related topics. But what I do want to understand is, how do you think, do you think McDonald's will have to, as they source new eggs, will likely have to pay more for their eggs? And the second part of that observation was, will they pass the price increase on to the customer? Do you think that an Egg McMuffin now will cost, $2.59 instead of $2.49?
No. McDonald's said that there's not going to be a supply disruption, and it's not going to affect the price of eggs. I think what it really boils down to is that as a society of eaters, we are accustomed to buying chicken for 49 cents a pound, and it's the same. You hear the same argument in the fossil fuel discussion. If you have a gas
it's
tax,
regulated and
right,
it's,
people
it's
will drive
so subsidized
less.
That we're actually it's not chicken should cost more.
Just like supermarkets give away turkeys for free, and they make their money on the stuffing and the sides. You know, there's no way that a turkey should cost as little as it does, if anything at all. So this is part of the problem. I mean,
this is why you should buy higher turkeys.
The only way to sell an Egg McMuffin for 99 cents or whatever it costs is to produce chickens this way, or produce egg-laying chickens this way. And it's that's the tension there in this whole situation.
And that's amazing. Well, we're drinking beer now, but we do have a nice bottle of Douro Red here that is mercifully in a screw cap, and I tell my my trusty caped Crusader producer Jack, this is the best cheeseburger wine in the business. So if you're at Roberta's and you're having one of the Roberta's famous cheeseburgers, you can hear that. It's nice. It's the Douro 2005. We're gonna crack this, and we're gonna head to commercial here for a minute. When we get back, we're gonna have more talk with Mr. Justin Roark, and give you a little tasting note on this wine. Take care, guys. We'll be back. Yeah.
Oblique. She called me.
Okay, welcome back, everyone, to this week's episode of Unfiltered. I'm your host, Brian DeMarco, and sitting in for the lovely, talented, and absent Aaron Fitzpatrick is Mr. Justin Rowick today.
Hello.
And we've had some very interesting chats on the earlier segment here about eggs production at McDonald's. And we just cracked open a bottle of the 2005 vintage Vidigal Douro from Portugal. And it's funny, what do you think about this wine, Justin?
It's nice. It's
cheap,
nice.
Cheap and cheerful.
It's very...
And, you know, the thing that the Portuguese wine is, you know, for the most part, I think misunderstood from the mass market. But they really are this really unique blend of old world values, old world production, and in this specific case, new world type of wine. And most people think of Portugal for port, making port wines, and the Douro specifically because of the international trade in port for many years. But this wine is no more than $15 retail on a shelf, and it just delivers a lot of pleasure for what it does. But
so what's it called?
Vidigal Douro, and it's interesting. The Douro region, like I said, is mostly famous for port production, but they're making a lot of still wines, and the region itself has had a sort of renaissance in the last 5 or 6 years, despite the financial crisis that's happened to Portugal. These guys seem to be able to make great wines and get them out internationally, which is good for them. Like I said, that's old world, so they've been doing this for, you know, generations, but people are rediscovering Portugal as if it's a new topic. I do have another bit of news, and then we're going to get into one of our favorite topics on the show here is China. But, you know, I read an article. I'm not sure how dated it is, but it has to do with, well, you know, as a caveat, one of my clients, a good client, Wine Library, but it has to deal with data and the encryption of data and the fact that, you know, customer data is never really safe. And Wine Library apparently had their entire site hacked. And it was interesting to note that, you know, Gary Vaynerchuk and sort of his aplomb came saying that, you know, everyone would be protected and nothing would be, you know, they've hired a third party person. And it's weird, you know, I guess, you know, this happens when they found out where it came from. It was from China. They were hacked from China and all their customer data was stolen. So anyone who had made a purchase at Wine Library, their credit card information was essentially up for grabs. So there's two topics here. One of them is that they were, you know, technically storing customer information, addresses, credit card numbers, and the like on their server, which apparently falls into some online internet crime in itself, where they're not supposed to store customer data for that. But two, then it becomes this their culpability where, yes, but they're not the crooks. You know, they were not trying to steal their customers' data. They were storing it. And so someone steals the data, and who's responsible? And a lot of people are pointing to Wine Library saying, well, you know, the information was stolen from them. They're responsible. Well, that's really not the case. I mean, they're not the thief, but they now are criminally liable. I guess it's when you don't shovel your walk in front of your snowy driveway and someone falls, it's your fault. And I guess it doesn't really matter that Wine Library had the best intentions and they're obviously doing the right thing by their, you know, their customers in their mind, but they may be actually be in for a very big fine for having their information hacked.
This actually goes right back to what we were discussing a couple of minutes ago about McDonald's. McDonald's customers, now, as I said, this had nothing to do with food safety, but Sparbo Farms did get a letter from the FDA on Wednesday that they were in gross violation, negligent violation of food safety regulations to prevent salmonella. The customers don't care if it was that McDonald's bought the eggs from Cargill, which bought the eggs from Sparbo, which had blames right. It on somebody else. I mean, it ultimately comes back to
McDonald's,
which is why, you could tell all the customers of Wine Library, yes, it wasn't us, it was this, it was this, it was this, it was this. But ultimately, it comes back to whose name is on the door, for you know, for right. For lack of a better.
So, if one of these customers or any of these customers find their credit card data has been compromised,
it's Visa's problem,
right? It becomes Visa's problem, you know.
But it becomes the customer's problem eventually because Visa has to make that money back one day.
And they may go after Wine Library. So, you know, we'll keep you informed as we know more. But, I mean, honestly, I feel like it's a heinous crime perpetrated on Wine Library, and they should not suffer for this. But in the same note, their lack of security measures, you know, made them a target. So, you know, who's to say who's right?
I mean, look, the Pentagon was hacked into a couple of weeks ago. I mean, I spoke with some online security guys. This happens every single day. I spoke with a guy who used to be in counterintelligence with the U.S. government, and he said that this is not even something that anyone bats an eyelash about. They're hacking, and it's generally coming from China, the intrusions from what they've found. I mean, they're hacking into the FBI's network. Well, they're hacking into the military's network.
In some regard, because they've paid for everything, maybe they feel like they're entitled to, well, you know, they're entitled to get a little piece of the action. And if they can't get it by legal means, by any means. So this leads us into, obviously a topic on this show, and if people who know me personally, multiple trips to China and dealing with China, it keeps coming up and it's not going away. So, Justin, you brought this incredible article to me about China. I'll let you take us out.
Well, there are two interesting parts of this story. It's actually two stories, but with the weak economy here in the States and also that of Europe and China booming, although not as much as it was this time last year, but still doing a lot better than pretty much anywhere else in the world, the Chinese have started to drink a lot more wine.
Which is something we've discussed at both levels. I mean, they're drinking, the middle is really, there is no middle consumer, just like there's no middle class in China. So the wine consumption, for those of you who are, you know, consistent listeners, know that they're buying Lafite on one side of it, and on the other side they're drinking $5 Planck because, you know, they've been drinking rice wine for 2,000 years. So the wine is part of their culture and will continue to grow, but it really is at the opposite ends of the spectrum.
Well, one of the things that this it's an Associated Press article discusses is exactly that, that there is no middle market. It just really doesn't exist. This guy, Pancho Campo, president of the Wine Academy of Spain.
I know him personally.
Do
yeah.
you?
Yeah, I do.
Pancho said that the exactly what you just did, the wine market split between the high end and the low end. but what's been happening is that it's sort of exactly what's happened with electronics and clothing and et cetera. The counterfeiters in China have identified a business opportunity here. A counterfeiter that France 24 spoke to, named Sheng Wen, said, "Wine seen as a rich person's drink, and that means everyone wants to be seen drinking it." According to Mr. Sheng, the counterfeiters look for original bottles in the trash cans of restaurants.
Or
on eBay. Mm. As a matter of fact, I've seen empty high-end wine bottles for sale on eBay.
You could just come to my office for that and take out my trash, but that's okay. But continue.
Well, they get these empty bottles. They replicate the labels, and then they buy... I guess this is where the mid-range market exists. They buy mid-range wines from the supermarket, according to this guy, and they pour them into the fake bottles. And pretty low tech, I guess. But they say that one of the major victims of Chinese counterfeiting is the Chateau Lafite Rothschild 82. That's gained more popularity. Is the a quote here? More popularity in China than in its home country. And
there's probably more bottles of it sold recently in China than have been worldwide.
Not only that, there are more there's more Lafitte 82 in China than was produced in France, according to the AFP. So they've estimated that about 70% of the Lafitte sold in China is fake.
But let me ask you this, or it's not me really ask you, it's more of an observation. Then they can't be by, there's not enough turn on the bottles of 82 Lafitte as far as drinking goes to use an authentic 82 bottle. So you're suggesting that they're not only, they're probably getting a Lafitte bottle, it could be the worst vintage ever, it could be a 74 Lafitte, whatever, no one cares. And then they're reproducing an 82 Lafitte label, they're counterfeiting the label. Is that what you're, I mean, because if there's more Lafitte on the market than has been made,
they're counterfeiting the labels.
They have to be. They have
That's
to be.
Exactly. No, it says that once they get one, they reproduce the label, replicate the bottle.
Mm-hmm.
So they're pretty good. I mean, these guys, I don't know if you've seen any really good. I mean, obviously, they're the low end knockoffs that everyone can tell when they see a.
You know, when we were in China, there's fake and there's real fake.
Right.
And fake is when they take like a Gucci handbag and they reproduce it exactly, and it says Gucci, and like there's only like, you know, Elsa Peretti or Tim Gunn would understand, you know, what the difference is. But then there's fake, and where they even spell, it's like they spell Gucci Guxi, like G-U-X-X-I, and it's totally not the same, but it's close enough where people are like, you know, it's $5 for like a $400 handbag. So
Right. It's
clear that it's not the same.
They just there's an In-N-Out. Well, people thought it was an In-N-Out burger opening up in Shanghai. story came out a few weeks ago on one of my favorite sites, Shanghaiist.com. a storefront with a construction like a facade out front,
right?
Showed that they had pictures of the double. They had all of the the animal fries, and
right.
Turns out that it's something called California Burger. It's an identical menu, but they're knocking that. I mean, they knocked off an entire Apple store in a town in China. I mean, they're really really amazingly skilled at reproducing things exactly, but. It sounds like, look, we used to think of things that were made in Japan as low end. And now you wouldn't think of buying something as in the electronics field that wasn't made in Japan. And now it's sort of Korea is getting into it. But I think eventually China is going to be seen as a real innovator, and they're going to be producing their own things, not just copying.
Well, I mean, I have to admit, though, that, you know, like, there was a great article about Sony, and it's like, what has Sony done since the Walkman? You know, nothing.
Not a whole lot.
Nothing. You know, they're amazing. They have like amazing headphones and amazing TVs, and they have, you know, they make amazing products, but they're not innovative. They're not cutting edge anymore, and they're reproducing things of high quality, but they're, you know, Philips designed it, or the chips are invented in America, mm-hmm. or, you know, the technology is uniquely American, or now Samsung and Korea has come out with some crazy things. But I mean, this, we get off topic, but I guess my point is that China, for the most part, is doing it cheaper, faster, and then for the privilege of having them work with you, they stretch you out on payments. So it's an incredible model, and I think with wine, I mean, the big disconnect, at least for me in this show, is that, you know, we don't talk about Chinese food and wine. You know, you talk about Thai food and Riesling, you talk about, you know, steaks and Bordeaux, you talk about Rhone wines and stew. We've talked ad nauseum about how wine and food fit together. And in China, you know, until the culture really sees wine as part of their meal, I'm not sure that they will get it or have an appreciation for fake versus real, or it will just be seen as sort of like almost a liquor category. You know,
you bring up an interesting point, because that's something that that this piece was talking about as well. Your buddy Pancho, his quote is, It has nothing to do with food pairing. It's just to do with ganbai, which is the nastrovia, or the cheers.
It's kumpai,
it's the chin-chin.
Right.
So, they don't apparently. I mean, they don't drink wine with food.
I think they treat it as if it's tequila, and I think that not everyone, but I think the high end products are viewed the way, you know. When I was in China, the stories were still that they're mixing, you know, Lafite with Coca-Cola, which is kind of it probably did happen. I didn't see it happen myself. When I brought that topic up, people would say, "Oh, that was 2 years ago." Now they're taking smaller, almost, you know, very high-end shot glasses, but, you know, small glasses nevertheless, and pouring Lafite in, you know, a table of four guys will buy the bottle of Lafite, and then they'll drink it one shot at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll slam it. So they're not savoring it. Of course, this is a complete generalization, but I happened to witness this myself. So I didn't witness anyone pouring Coca-Cola into their wine, but I did witness guys high-end nightclub where people were buying Lafite for $500 a bottle, and that they were drinking it in 2 ounce shots until it was gone. And then when that was over, they ordered another bottle of it. And they got drunk the old fashioned way, you know, like it was tequila, but in their mind, it was no different than bottle service at a nightclub.
Well, it's a good thing we don't see any of this sort of, you know, behavior going on in the U.S. We have one of the most sophisticated societies here globally, I would say. I mean, you don't see any bad behavior going on in America.
Well, it's great because, you know, the Jägermeister days are far behind us, and, you know, I can't.
Absolutely.
And all those ski movies where you get drunk, you know, at a après ski, those are just.
Girls Gone Wild went away, it's, you know, everything was back to normal.
Yeah, it's all, yeah, we're back to wholesome goodness here.
That's right.
But what's the moral of the story for China? Like, what do you think is the, you know, you're the writer, you see these stories aren't going away. What do you think, how do we protect ourselves from fraud? Two, how do we educate the Chinese consumer to the point where they self-regulate or self-police? And three, you know, why would the French even care at this point? I mean, like, yeah, they care that their products are being counterfeited, but the cult of Lafite, you know, while it has cooled off a bit in the auction market, I can verify that. I talked to John Capon the other day at Acker Merrill, and he let me know that Lafite has cooled off dramatically, and that while it's still strong, only the key vintages are strong. So before, you know, off vintages of Lafite no one cared about in the U.S. would sell for what they were supposed to sell for, maybe $100 a bottle. And now, and in the initial craze, people just wanted it. Didn't matter the vintage. And now those sales have really cooled off. So we, you know, maybe the faking, like the 82, you know, to your point, they're really only going after the top trophy wines.
Well, I think what we're seeing in China now is not unlike what every country that creates a new middle class, a new upper middle class, a new investor class goes through. I don't think that anything that's happening in China isn't anything that didn't go on anyplace else at this point in their development.
It's a very macro view of you, Justin.
Well, I mean, it's easy to, and I'm certainly one of the main culprits, but you know, it's easy to sort of to generalize and joke around about the. the bogus products that come out and the misspelled, you know, Google phone or whatever. But, you know, we got to remember that this is a very recent phenomenon that China has opened up like this.
Mm-hmm.
So I think time will tell. You know, I don't think that any of the prognosticators are going to get this one right. As far as protecting the United States against fraud, I don't think that that's ever going to. I think that that's equivalent to trying to win the war on drugs. I mean,
right.
It's never going to go away. You're never going to get rid of the criminal element anywhere in the world. But you know, that said, there's a robust set of industries that exist to combat this sort of thing.
Well, I mean, I guess again, it will be. really largely dependent on the sophistication and desire of the Chinese public at large to be part of that that upwardly mobile clique. And if wine still is one of the badge items that allow people to feel like they're moved into this new middle class, then this isn't ending anytime soon.
No, I think you're absolutely right, and I think only time will tell how this all plays out. But I would bet that it's going to play out exactly the same way as it played out in the U.S. and in Japan and in Indonesia and in Brazil and everywhere else. The question is, what's the next China going to be? I mean, we're almost at the point now where it's been so. China's such a popular destination for investors. Every company wants to be there because there are a lot of people in China. Obviously, what's next? Is it going to be Vietnam? Is it going to be Brazil? Is it going
to
be
back to Mexico?
Mexico. It could be anywhere. I mean, the wages in China are now being pushed up to the point where it's becoming less and less profitable to produce goods there. And Chinese companies are actually outsourcing some of their production to Mexico.
Which is just insane.
Foxconn just opened a factory in Guadalajara. So
that's amazing. Yeah. Well, this obviously let's end this China Lafite conversation with the last bit of this deliciously fruity Vidigal d'Oro 2005, and I'll do the pleasure of signing us off for another successful and enlightening episode of Unfiltered here on the Heritage Radio Network. And stay tuned, guys. We'll be back in the audience in the studio next week, and we'll see you then. Take care.
The following is a message from Jones Family Farms. Jones Family Farms is a 400-acre working farm offering quality agricultural products all year round, from fresh summer berries to Christmas trees in the winter, and an award-winning winery that is open from April to December. The reach of the Jones Family Farms is hard to capture, from their advocacy work through the Working Lands Alliance to ongoing classes in the Harvest Kitchen. Jones Family Farms is as passionate about education as it is about farming. Whether you're picking fresh strawberries or exploring local wines, we hope you're inspired to learn more about Connecticut farming. Visit www.jonesfamilyfarms.com for more information.